This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Interesting trends, if one looks at the mega trends, at the wider picture, that begin to formulate in one's mind. And that is, as strange as it sounds, there is occurring a drawing together of the values of the secular world and the values of the Torah. One always used to wonder how, when Mashiach came, it would all be handled. There was such a vast gap between secular thinking and the values of the Torah that one couldn't quite imagine how an individual would come and somehow align these two different ways of thinking in some kind of way that they could, that there was a basis for communication. And yet, little by little, again, only in terms of the megatrends, not in terms of people's individual behavior, that gap is being bridged. The gap is being bridged, interestingly, and rather disturbingly. What's happening is that the values of I'm not even Torah as such, but we can talk about all religions. The values of religions, including Yiddishkeit to a large extent, are moving closer to the secular. And the values of the secular are moving closer to the Torah. And that part, of course, is a disturbing movement. That means we're moving further away and they're coming closer. And it's perhaps in this shiurim, the Motzei Shabbos shiurim, more than in any of the other shiurim, that the interface between my work in the Institute of Business Ethics and in Torah come together. And it's that interface that I want to explore a little bit today with you. In the Torah world and in the religious world, there is much more emphasis on externalism. Let's forget about the other religions. Let's talk about ours. Much more emphasis on the physical than there used to be. Much more emphasis on the measurable than there used to be. Much less emphasis on true understanding. There's an emphasis on information. And the whole learning process is moving away, over the last 50 years, has moved from deep spiritual understanding to superficial quantitative information gathering. That's been the move in the Torah world. Vast information gathering and the learning and the shiurim that take place generally. I'm talking again about the general. Of course, it's difficult to generalize because there are some exceptional thinkers and Talmidei Chachamim of great stature today, as well as they have been in every generation. But those small little units scattered all over the world, the bulk movement is away from deep understanding towards superficial information. It is away from spiritual values to material expressions. To externalisms, measurements, and things are need to be very measurable. Things aren't measurable; they're not understood. I think it was in the shiur, it might have been in one of the others, that I gave the example of that my daughter told me. Ashira, who's here at the moment, when she got to New York and they were trying to figure out who she is and where she comes from, they tried to do it by asking her questions like, "What color hat did her father wear?" And does he have a beard or doesn't he have a beard, and does his yarmulke stick out of his hat or doesn't it stick out of his hat? Those were the kind of questions they used to try and fit her into some kind of a box. Otherwise, who knows who she is and where she comes from? Everything is worked out in a very measurable way. People are classified into groups that are determined by very superficial factors, not by anything deep. So in the spiritual world, in the world of the Torah, the move has been away from spiritual towards material. Away from the immeasurables towards the measurables. In the business world, the opposite is happening. The move is away from the measurables towards the immeasurables. The move is away from pure quantification to deeper spiritual values. And again, I'm not suggesting that that's so necessarily in the individual conduct of businessmen today, but in terms of megatrends of the way business thinkers are thinking. And some months ago, I spoke to you about the impact of instant information and of technology and how that in itself makes the environment in which we're operating a much more spiritual environment. The role that knowledge and that information is playing in business today is much, much greater than it's ever been before. The intellectual component of products, never mind of services, the intellectual component of products is vastly greater than it ever used to be before. In the old days, if you bought a washing machine, 90% of the cost of the washing machine was in the labor and the materials. Big, solid thing that had to be made from iron, and that had to be moved around the place and shipped, and it was that's what you paid for. Today, you take the materials of the washing machine, it's a couple of rands of material. That's not what you're paying for. You're paying for the chokhmah, the technology. There are brains in that washing machine, and that's what you're paying for. More and more products are differentiated by the chokhmah, not by the material that they're made from. There again, we see the move in the physical world, in the secular world, away from matter towards intellect, towards spiritual. And if you look at the economy, certainly in the Western world today, the number of people who are making their living out of thinking compared to out of actually working physical labor, it's never been so great. The proportions are very high of the number of people who are in the service industry, people who, the accountants and the lawyers and the scientists, the technologists, the consultants, are all people who are using their brains and are selling their brain power, selling their ideas. And a large part of the economy is now in ideas. The world is dealing in ideas, not in products. Those ideas are then put into products, and that differentiates the product. But what people are paying for are the ideas, not the product. That's an incredible thing. So the secular world, the business world, is trading in ideas. And the frum world is trading in hechsherim. That's what's happened. Whereas it used to be the other way around. It used to be, we used to say, Asheki deshona b'mitzvayso v'tzivonu la'asuk v'divrei Torah. What was our business? La'asuk v'divrei Torah. We were trading ideas. If two Talmidei Chachamim met, if two Yeshiva Bochrim met, what did they talk about? What did they exchange? They exchanged ideas, chidushim. Today it's a question, what are they exchanging about if you're going to, if a girl's going to marry a boy from Ponovich, then she can demand so and so many rooms in an apartment, and whether she can get a Volvo, or she can even ask for a Mercedes-Benz, or he can ask for a Volvo or for a Mercedes-Benz. The whole thing has become terribly quantified. A couple sit down for a shidduch, but after a couple of times, the parents are getting together discussing money. That's what the shidduch revolves around. So the business world is moving from money to ideas, and the Torah world is busy moving from ideas into money. That's what it is. Torah has become a business. When a Rosh Hashiva comes to talk, in the old days, the Rosh Hashivas used to come, Ponovich Rav used to come to South Africa, his son told me, that never in his entire life did the Ponovich Rav ask anybody for money. He used to come to raise money, that's what he came for. And he used to go from house to house to visit people. Never asked for money. He talked about ideas. He talked about the yeshiva. He talked about his thoughts. And usually people gave him money. They realized what he'd come for, but he never asked for money. Nowadays, it's hardly ever that a Rosh Yeshiva gives you a new idea when he comes to see you. He's got to get his money, and he's got to, you know, he's got turnover to do. Please excuse me, I've got to get on. We used to trade in ideas, and they used to trade in money. Now they're beginning to trade in ideas, and we're beginning to trade in money. And that's very, very disturbing. But I want to give you another area where you see the things that the business world is grappling with. And there's an interesting business thinker at the moment whose name is Chris Argyris. He's a professor at Harvard. He's written a number of books, difficult books. And I'm going to tell you some of his theory. And then I'm going to show it to you in the Torah. The issue that he examines in perhaps the most thorough way that anybody has examined is what stops people in business organizations from learning. Why do people make the same mistakes over and over again? Why don't people identify mistakes and faults? What is it that gets in the way of a learning process? Because here again, now the very question shows you what's happening. So people are now beginning to look at business organizations as yeshivas, in quotation marks, as learning places, places where you learn. As business used to be a place that you went to earn your living, and you went to yeshiva to learn, now business is a place where you learn, and you open a yeshiva to earn a living. The whole thing is weird. Yeshivas have become a business, and business has become a learning process. And there's a lot of discussion as to how to improve. In fact, most of the discussion, most of the thinking in business today is how to improve the quality of learning and quality of thinking in the business environment, because there's a realization that most of the competitive advantage of businesses and of products lies in their ability to think, in their ability to innovate, in being mechadesh, in chidushim. They realize that, and for that there needs to be an intellectual environment that encourages people to think. And part of that needs to be an ability to move away from mistakes, to identify a mistake and to move away from the mistake, to find the solution to the mistake. And most of his study has been what stops people learning. He's quite critical. This is people talk about learning and they talk about improving, but they don't notice it doesn't happen. Lemaise, it doesn't happen. You can have all the theories you want to, but in fact it doesn't happen. And that's a problem that we have in the Torah world, the world we have it in any education institution, any educational institution. People hear things, but they don't learn them. They don't modify behavior on the basis of what they've heard. What gets in the way? And he says basically two things get in the way. And I believe the two are really one. The first thing he says that gets in the way is this whole story of positive thinking. You must always be positive. And you must always talk people up. And he says, in the name of positive thinking, managers often censor what they see as a Pandora's box of problems. So in order to be positive, not to focus on the negative, which is important, one must be positive, but there's sometimes it's taken to an extreme where in order to not be accused of being negative, and the moment somebody does say something negative and people say you're being negative, so the tendency is to forget about the negative altogether and only to focus on the positive. Now, focusing on the positive is very important if the positive is used to address the inadequacies of the negative. But if the positive is used to ignore and to be blinded to the negative, then you have a learning block. And he says, therefore, people will not want to damage morale, they won't want to hurt people, they want to be considerate. All of a sudden you see now middas coming into it. Amazing what's happening in business. Because people want to be considerate of one another, they've stopped criticizing each other effectively and glossing over mistakes and glossing over errors and pushing it aside and not really dealing with it. That, he says, is the one reason for it. Then he says there's a deeper and more complex psychological reason. And this is what he calls a process of defensive reasoning. Before I explain the process of defensive reasoning, let me explain to you what Argyris sees as learning. Very fascinating concept. Because what does it mean to learn? And he says in business, there are two kinds of learning. The one kind of learning he calls single loop learning. You identify a problem, you solve the problem. And that's what businesses traditionally do, and that's what most people traditionally do, if you're lucky. They'll focus, identify a problem, fix the problem, and feel fantastic they fixed the problem. He says, but sometimes they've only fixed the symptom, they haven't fixed the cause. And the example he gives is a thermostat. He says, a thermostat is designed for single loop learning. It notices when the temperature drops below a set level, and it corrects it. Turns on the heating. And when the temperature hits up at a certain level, it notices it and corrects it. Turns off the heating. That's single loop learning. He says, but a thermostat that can ask, is the setting appropriate? Why was the setting chosen? Was the setting chosen to conserve fuel? Or was the setting chosen because in this environment that's the most comfortable temperature to operate in? If the thermostat theoretically could ask those kind of questions and maybe change the setting, that would be double loop learning. He calls that double loop learning, where you actually question the premise. Single loop learning is when you correct things within the premise. There's a certain premise, something's not behaving according to the premise, identify, correct. But that keeps on recurring because you're not looking at the premise. Maybe the premise is the problem. When you can challenge the premise and check whether the premise is right, then you start the process of double loop learning. And what gets in the way of double loop learning is defensive reasoning. Defensive reasoning basically is that people don't see any fault in themselves. And that whenever anybody's asked to identify a problem, he focuses the cause of the problem outside of himself. It's bad management, it's bad labor, it's bad marketing. There'll always be reasons outside of himself as to why things aren't what they should be. And he's studied thousands, he did 6,000 major studies of people from all different cultures and management levels throughout the world. And he found no difference in that. That no matter what culture, no matter what background someone comes from, the tendency is exactly the same to get into a process of defensive reasoning. And he questions why. Here I'm interpreting and going a little bit further than what he says. defense of learning is designed not to feel bad. People don't like feeling bad. And people are willing to do a lot to avoid feeling bad. And that's the basis for the whole escapism industry. People watch movies, television, gamble, drink, all sorts of things people will do to escape feeling bad. There is no value, our society attaches no value whatever to feeling bad. The psychologist, if you talk about feeling bad involving any kind of guilt, the psychologist will say what a terrible thing guilt is, shouldn't have guilt. If one feels a little bit depressed, it's depression, terrible thing. If one feels concerned, then you're being over serious, and you're supposed to be happy. Everybody's supposed to be happy all the time. There's a tremendous emphasis on never feeling bad. Feeling bad is seen and perceived and felt as being totally negative. And people will do a lot to escape from feeling bad. I don't want to feel bad. And what causes bad feeling? Failure causes terrible bad feeling. Rejection. Those are the things that really cause one to feel bad. And the way we operate in our society doesn't allow for failure. There's no value given to failure, whatever. And then failure is something that creates a very, very negative environment. He says, and here I'll read you his words because they're very accurate, the purpose of the strategy, that is defensive reasoning, to always find the fault in somebody else, is to avoid vulnerability, risk, embarrassment, and the appearance of incompetence. Nobody wants to put himself at risk, nobody wants to be vulnerable, nobody wants to be embarrassed, and nobody wants to appear incompetent. Because we're here, I'm onto my own words again, because here we live in a society that when they detect vulnerability and weakness, they capitalize on it and maximize on it. So you're living in a society that doesn't allow you to be vulnerable. It exploits vulnerability. So we will do anything, and this applies not only in business, this is in human relationships as well, this is in family relationships, this is the whole society in which we're operating. This is the sickness of society, more than anything else. This is the sickness of society, that we're operating in a society that exploits weakness. And therefore we will do anything, like animals do, not to demonstrate, not to show that we're weak. Back to his words. In other words, it is a deeply defensive strategy and a recipe for ineffective learning, because it will never allow you to confront the fact that you've made a mistake, that you failed, because you're terrified of doing that. We might even call it a recipe for anti-learning, because it helps us avoid reflecting on the counterproductive consequences of our own behavior. What am I doing that's causing this kind of reaction? If people are behaving in this way towards me, what am I doing wrong that gives rise to this? Very hard for a person to look at, because he feels that the moment he does so, it's going to expose himself. These theories assume a world that prizes unilateral control and winning above all else. And we do. Winning is what's important. And that's why in business now this has become a big term. Winning organizations, the importance of winning, and they use that kind of terminology to beat the competition, to win, winning strategies, to destroy the competition. The competitiveness of business and of other areas of life is one that prizes unilateral control and winning above all else. And in that world, we focus primarily on controlling others and on making sure that we are not ourselves controlled. If any reflection does occur, if we do try and look at ourselves, it is in the service of winning and controlling, not of opening ourselves to learning. Now, what Argyris doesn't do is get into the whole area of saying, well, in that case, before we can allow learning to take place, we've really got to change the whole morality and ethics of the environment in which that learning is trying to take place. Because if you're operating in an environment that is going to exploit weakness, you can't learn. That's his chiddush. If you're operating in an unethical environment, learning can't take place. If you're operating in a highly competitive environment, learning can't take place. All you can do is focus on trying to beat the other person. That's fine. If you're playing a sport, you can focus on your competing side, and you can try and improve yourself and improve yourself and improve yourself until you're able to beat the other side. But if you're operating in something that's more serious than sport, although one wouldn't think at the moment that there's anything more serious than sport, but if one's operating in an area that's more serious than sport and one wants a learning environment where people are able to genuinely grow and learn, you can't have that competitive environment. There's got to be a different kind of competition. One needs competition, we'll talk about that, but it needs to be a different kind of competition. And an environment that values winning over all else is an environment that inhibits the process of learning. That is chidush. But in that case, the only way that you can achieve learning is by ensuring that the environment in which you're operating in doesn't value winning above all else. Now, how do you change that in a business? How can you operate in a competitive business environment, and as the world gets more global, business becomes more competitive, how can you operate in a competitive business environment and try and achieve an environment which allows learning to take place? We're not even talking about an environment that encourages learning. The importance of his discovery is it doesn't allow learning to take place. It cannot take place. You can't learn in an environment that demands zero defect. You can't learn in an environment that values winning over all else, an environment for which there's only one right answer, and that's getting it right, and that all, and anything else is failure. This tension between conquest and learning, as I would call it, the environment, the culture of conquest, of winning above all else, of controlling and not being controlled, that's the culture of conquest. The culture of conquest and the culture of learning, says Argyris, are mutually exclusive. And I want to suggest that's the tension between Yaakov and Esav. And the Torah says, and we'll look at the interaction between ourselves and Esav. When the two boys became older, says the Torah, Yaakov and Esav, Vayigdalu hanorim, Vayehi Esav ish yodeya tzayid, ish sodeh. Esav was a man who knew how to hunt, a man of the field. Vayakov ish tom yoshev ohalim. And man, Rabbi Nesadya Gaon defines ishtom as an ish makshovo, yadon, as an intellectual, a thinker, a learner. Yoshev ohalim, who dwelt in tents. What are the ohalim? What are the tents in the plural? Says Rashi, ohalo shel shem, v'ohalo shel eiver. He dwelt, ohal means a beis hamedrash. And the beis, they didn't have a beis hamedrash there, they didn't have Torah. It was a house of learning. A beis hamedrash in the literal sense. A house of learning. What did they have to learn? Their own minds, their own self-analyses, what had been passed down to them from Adam Harishon. They didn't have the Torah as we have it today. It doesn't matter. He still sat in the house of learning. There were houses of learning before there was the Torah, before the Torah was given to us. There were houses of learning. There were places of learning. And Yaakov used to stay in the was it Yeshev Oholim, who used to find themselves in the houses of learning. So we have two personalities. One is an Ish Tzayid, a hunter. What does that mean, says Rashi? Yodeya Tzayid, he knew how to hunt. Lotzud ularamis es oviv befiv. He knew how to use his mouth to hunt and to crook his father. Bashoalo, he would say, for example, Abrahech Masis HaMelach ves HaKeven, used to present himself as being very frum. How do you take miso from salt and from straw? Kasover ovav shu medakdek b'mitzvahs. His father thought that he was very, very meticulous about the keeping of mitzvahs. And elsewhere, Chazal say that Yodea Tzayid was that he knew how to hunt women away from their husbands. The emphasis on conquest, the hunting dynamic is one of conquest. And whereas the simple meaning is Yodea Tzayid Ishtode, that he was a hunter of animals, we see already in Rashi and in Chazal that was his whole methodology, that was his whole process, that was his whole psyche. It was one of gaining his sense of self-esteem and value through conquest, through using his wits to outwit the enemy. Whoever the enemy might be, it was sometimes his father, it was sometimes the husbands of wives that he liked, it was sometimes animals, it doesn't make any difference. That was his involvement, and that's what he did. Vayehav Yitzchok es Esav ki tzayid befiv. And Yitzchok loved not only Yaakov but also Esav ki tzayid befiv. Says Rashi, befiv shel Esav sho yotzad Esav rameyu bidvarov. He was so skillful that he managed to conquer his father. And his father believed in him, although he was a wicked man. So the one aspect of Esav is conquest. The other aspect of Esav is You'll remember the story then. Yaakov is cooking up the lentils, and in walks Esav, the hu oyef, and he was tired. And he says, Haliteini no min ha'adoim ha'adoim hazeh. Give me some of this red stuff. Ki ayef anoichi, because I'm tired. And Yaakov then says, all right, I'll give you some, but sell me your birthright. So interesting, what is a birthright? What is a bechira? A bechira entitles him to the brachas. It's the future, it's serving Hashem. The bechira had the function of a kohen, of a levi. He was supposed to be the spiritual heart of the family. That's what it was meant to be. Yaakov realizes that to Yosef, bechira is an asset, a disposable asset. It has monetary value, because anything that doesn't have monetary value, according to Esav, doesn't have value at all. So Yaakov enters into this absurd negotiation for a bechira. Esav says, sure, I'm going to die in any case. What good is a bechira to me if I'm going to die? He doesn't value anything spiritual. Things only have value as long as I'm alive, as long as we can trade in them. So they trade in it. And by the way, he doesn't exchange the birthright for the lentil soup. It says, Vayimkur es bechirosu liyakuv. He sold his birthright to Yaakov, full stop. And then it says, the Yaakov nosun leisav lechim unazidadoshim. And then Yaakov gave him the food. Says the Rashbam, that means the sale was for money. He bought the bechira for cash. The condition of the sale was, if the sale goes through and I pay for it, then I'll give you food as well. Then he gave him the food. He didn't sell it for the food. What's the basis of Yaakov suggesting the sale? Explains the Sifunu. You, Esav, are so dedicated to your work that you are so tired that you can't even call it lentil soup. You're so tired that you can't even look at what I'm cooking and notice what it really is. That you just call it ha'adoim ha'adoim hazeh, this red stuff. You're just relating to the world so superficially, because your mind is so drained. And why is it so drained? Because you're so dedicated to your job. Clearly you can't do justice to the requirements of the birthright. To serve Hashem, and to do what a bechor is supposed to do. You're involved in your work and that's it. So now we're getting a picture of Esav. Esav is driven by the conquering dynamic and totally, totally involved in it. His whole mind and everything is in winning. That's what he's doing. So according to Argyris, Esav is an anti-learner. And Yaakov identifies that and says, you're an anti-learner by the fact that you're so dedicated to the process of hunting, in the wider ramifications of hunting, you can't be a bechor. You can't be Mesharis Hashem. You can't self-improve. You can't learn. What's the bechor worth to you? And Esav agrees. And Yaakov takes the bechor. Then the story goes on, and before Yitzchak dies, he calls Esav to get him some food so he can give him a bracha. Rivka overhears it and tells Yaakov to go and get the food ready first and to present himself as if he were Esav, so that he will get the bracha, because she knows what's going on. What is the bracha he gets? Now, or even before that, when Yitzchak is trying to work out who this is, and he finally says, "Hakol kol Yaakov b'hayodayim yedei Esav," and I've learnt that before, as saying Yitzchak is saying this is almost a new creation. This is neither Yaakov nor Esav. This is a synthesis of the two. This is a man who has the inner values of Yaakov. How does he know that? Says Rashi, "Shemedaber beloshen tachanunim." He talks nicely. He says, "Kum no." He says, "Please, Father, get up and eat." Abul Esav b'lashon kanturiya dibe. But when Esav comes, he talks aggressively. He instructs, "Yokum avi, get up." That's the conquering element, showing my control, my power over you. It's very interesting, and I've demonstrated it in business many times, that the way a manager talks to a subordinate in business in the Western world is a way which if anybody talked to you like that outside of business, you would slap his face. You wouldn't accept it. It's totally rude. So why do you accept it? Because he's your boss. That's part of the whole controlled environment in which we operate. I can talk to you any way I like and you jolly well do it because I'm in control. That's how business is structured. And that's how Esav spoke. It's a businessman. Yochum Ovi. Get an instruction. Get up. Eat. And Esav and Yaakov says, Kumno, please, won't you get up? And Chazal also say Yaakov uses Hashem's name in the way he speaks. Esav didn't. So Yitzchok identifies the inner values of a Yaakov. And the hands of Esav, that doesn't just mean because they're furry. What he's saying is, I'm not quite sure who this is. It's either Esav who has developed the inner voice of Yaakov, or it's Yaakov who's developed the manipulative ability of Esav. Because he's dressed up like Esav. If it is Yaakov, then he's presenting himself like Esav, and he's using the skills of Esav. He's using the manipulative abilities of Esav. So this is a man who has a synthesis of the two. And he gives him the bracha. What is the bracha? So there should be, you should have dew and fat of the land and roiv dog on vesirish, yavducho amim. Then he says, yavducho amim, nations will serve you. V'yishtachavu l'chol l'umim, and peoples will bow down to you. Hevei gevir la'achecho v'yishtachavu l'chol b'nei yimecho. You will be the power over your brothers and the sons of your mother will bow down to you. V'rerecho orur u'mevorecho chaboruch, those who curse you will be cursed. Those who bless you will be blessed. Seems to be a bit of an implication that Yaakov's getting involved in the area of conquest here. That with this brocha of others are going to bow down to you, that Yaakov's getting involved in the area of conquest. Yavducha, I mean, nations will serve you. What does that mean? You will conquer them. Explains Rashi. Why does it use the word Elohim in this bracha, asks Rashi. Elohim means judge. Normally when we use a bracha, we say Hashem. Yudkei Vovkei, because that means chesed, that means kindness, giving, generating. You're giving a bracha, you use Hashem. Why is the word Elohim used? Yiten l'cho ha-Elohim mitala shemayim. Why Elohim? Says Rashi, taken from Tanna Dabei Eliyahu, Im roi l'cho yiten l'cho, v'im lav lo yiten l'cho. It's God the judge. This bracha I'm giving you is not unconditional. If you deserve it, you'll get it. And if you don't deserve it, I don't want him to give it to you. Aval Esav omar mishmoneh haaretz yiyeh meshavecha. With Esav he says, no matter what you'll get it, bein tzadik uvein rosho, you get the material things for no matter what. I'm not making it conditional to your morality, later on when he blesses Esav. So the non-Jewish world can have unconditional blessing, whereas the Jewish world has conditional blessing. Is that fair? Sure, because that increases our moral levels. That means we've got to know, we've got to earn it. Nothing's for nothing. And the Ribbono Shel Olam will respond, and what Yitzchok sets in motion in this bracha is the responsiveness between the Ribbono Shel Olam and our moral standing. The responsiveness between our material well-being and our moral standing. If we will be moral, if we will be fine, if we will be great, if we'll do the right things, we will have the material things that we need. And then, Yavducha, I mean, people will serve us. So how are we going to conquer the world? With might? With conquest? No, with morality. That's the only way we can conquer the world. In our relationship to Hashem is the only way we can do it. If we relate properly to the Ribbono Shel Olam, if our observance of the Torah is proper, and our moral standing is proper, then we will have the wherewithal which He will give us, which automatically will result in the fact that we will command the respect, the admiration, and the service of the other nations without having to engage in conflict with them. We don't have to get into conflict with them in order, so to say, to conquer them. Our conquest comes through knowledge. Our conquest comes through morality. Our conquest comes through nobility. Then, as you know, Esav comes along. What's the bracha that he gets? Esav comes and says, surely you've got a bracha for me as well. And Hashem says, and Yitzchak says, yes. Also offers him from the fat of the earth. And then he adds, Va'al charbecho tichye. You'll live by the sword. That's his bracha. So we need to know who we're dealing with, and we need to know what we're dealing with. We're dealing with two forces here. One force achieves prominence through its moral standing and its relationship with Hashem. And one force is al charbecho tichye, by conflict and by winning. And as Chris Argyris says, if that's the dynamic in Esav's life, it's anti-learning. There can't be learning. That doesn't support learning. then Esav has to succeed, and he can't tolerate failure, and he can't have somebody else winning, and he can't have somebody else doing well. He's always going to be on the top. He's got to be aggressive. He's got to be destructive. That's the nature of Esav. And you will serve your brother. The only thing is, you'll find that when your brother drops his spiritual level, says Rashi, when the Jewish people drop from those heights, then you won't have him over your neck. So Yisrael, Yaakov, is going to dominate Esav through its spiritual stature. But if the Jewish people lower their spiritual stature, Yaakov can no longer dominate Esav. Esav can no longer be dominated. Esav's only, the only capacity, the only method to dominate Esav is through the high spiritual stature of Yisrael. Then the story goes on, as you know. Finally, Yaakov runs away to Lavan, and years later he comes back and he's about to meet Esav. How does he handle that? And he's scared. He's so scared. He divides his camp into two so that if Esav wipes the one out, he won't. Well, he knows who Esav is. At least the other one will be able to escape. So he's expecting a holocaust. How does he handle Esav? So cleverly. There's only one way to handle an Esav. You've got to let him win. Because if you don't let him win, he'll fight. There is no other way to handle an Esav. So what does he do? He takes these enormous gifts. And he says, "Ki yifgoshecho Esav achiyu she'elecho leimol lemi'atov amutzelecho lemi'ele lefonecho." If Esav meets you with his presence and says, "Who are you? Where are you going? Where do you come from?" V'omatol avdechol Yaakov, you'll say they belong to your servant Yaakov. Mincho yishlucho la'adoni Esav. It's a present, it's a gift, but mincho is in terms of an atonement, a sacrifice. V'inei gamu achareinu, and he's coming as well. And he told the second lot and the third lot to say the same. Ki omar, and add, you should tell him, achaprofonov b'mincho ha'aleches lefonoi. Yaakov said, let me atone before my master Esav with this gift that I'm offering him. What is Yaakov atoning for? Does he think he's done anything wrong? He knows he hasn't. But he knows that's his only chance of survival. There's only one way to beat Esav, and that's to make sure that Esav thinks he's won. Because Esav will never settle if Esav hasn't won. He's living in a winning environment. He's living in an environment where victory and conquest is the only value worth striving for. Anything less than that is failure. Anything less than that is complete devastation. So he's got to win. He's got to fight. Yaakov comes along and says, you've won. I admit, I'm sorry. Atonement, forgive me. That takes the steam out of, the wind out of Esav's sails. If he's won, there's nothing to fight for. And they have a cordial interaction, and they disappear. They go into different directions and never see each other again until their father dies, and until much later on. Then there's the struggle between Yaakov and the angel of Esav. And this is quite an interesting one, because at the end of it, they battle, and Yaakov asks for a brocha, and the angel says, Lo Yaakov ye'amer oed shimcho, ki in Yisrael, you shall no longer be called Yaakov, now you'll be called Yisrael. Ki soriso im elokim v'im anoshim vatucho. Because you've battled with God, with an angel, and with human beings, and you've managed. You beat Lavan, and you beat me, the angel. So there's nobody you can't beat. And when I saw this piece of Chumash as I was preparing the shir, I thought, this blows the theory. And I'm going to have to work out another shir for tonight. Because here we see Yaakov is acknowledged and praised. Now you've made it. Now you're also in the world of battle and conquest. And that's the meaning of your name, Yisrael Kisori. So you've battled and you've won. Until I found the Sikunu. How come he won? Leroiv dveikusoi tomeid bokel yisborach v'machshova uvidibu. He won through consistent and continuous attachment to God in thought and in speech. That's how he won. He didn't win with physical strength. He was fighting an angel. How can he win? That's how he beat Lavan. That's how he beat the angel. That's the only way the Jew can win his battles, is through his connection with the Ribbono Shel. If he's closely connected to God and his moral stature is on the level, he can win his battles. If he's going to fight, try and fight Esav on Esav's terms, he can't possibly win. He's got to lose. Because Esav has to win. That's the nature of Esav, and Esav will fight to the death. So we see right in this interaction with Yaakov and Esav, we see this constant these two dynamics. Yaakov using his relationship to Hashem, his moral stature, his learning, his thinking, and Esav using his powers of deception, his ability to conquer, his physical strength, his might. Those are the two forces being used. There's an article in News in Time this week about George Soros. He's a very wealthy man. And the interesting thing is, when he was here, I heard him speak. The emphasis of his speech, and in Time magazine, it's just mentioned, by the way, that his training is in philosophy. He doesn't have a business training or background. But what was important is, in his speech that he gave here, he explained how his whole business has been developed on philosophy. His investment decisions aren't using normal business criteria. He thinks it through, using his Jewish kop. He thinks it through, using principles and moral principles. He works out where the right investments are. It's quite an amazing study. It's a different kind. They're wealthy Jews, and they're wealthy non-Jews. And there are some Jews whose wealth has been developed in non-Jewish ways, and there's some non-Jews maybe whose wealth has been developed in more of a Jewish way. There's a Jewish wealth and non-Jewish wealth. Non-Jewish wealth is through might, through strength, through taking advantage of situations, through spotting situations, all sorts of innovative ways that non-Jewish wealth occurs. Jewish wealth is different. Jewish wealth is applying a philosophy to an investment decision. That's how he became wealthy. That's the Yaakov way. The mind that he was supposed to put into Torah is put into business. Imagine what a gadol a man like that could have been had his mind been in Torah. Unbelievable mind. And the wealth is a function of his brilliance. Each decision you see that is a function of his brilliance, not just by chance that he did it. This conflict goes right into this week's Seder. You've probably been wondering, what's all this got to do with this week's Seder? I will tell you a secret, which I don't normally tell you. And that is, I prepared the shiur before I thought of how it connects to this week's shiur. I thought the principle was so important, and I'm busy in this at the moment in the business area, that I thought it's something I wanted to share with you. When I prepared the thought, I thought, now, what is it? There must be something in the Seder. And there is. The Bnei Yisrael are walking through the desert. Vayishlach Moshe malochim mikodesh melech Edom. And Moshe sends messengers to the king of Edom. Those are the descendants of Esav. Yeah, for the first time since the last parasha, we once again come into contact with Esav. Koyomar achicho Yisrael, we are your brother Yisrael. You know what's happened to us. We went to Egypt, and we sat in Egypt for many days, and we suffered. The Egyptians really gave us a tough time, and our fathers. So don't worry, we haven't come to conquer you. Vanitzak el Hashem, vayishma koleinu, and we shouted to Hashem, and He listened to us. Again, vanitzak el Hashem, we shouted to Hashem. How do you think we got out of Egypt? We tell Esau, not with your strength. We didn't fight our way out. If you were in Egypt, you would have conquered Egypt. You would have fought. We didn't. We turned to Hashem. Says Rashi, Vayishma Koleinu Hashem, listen to our voice. Bivrocho Sheberchonu Avinu. We use the brocha that our father gave us. Hakol Kol Yaakov. Rashi learns that when Yitzchok said Hakol Kol Yaakov, that wasn't just a statement of confusion. We see from this Rashi here in Parshas Chukas that Rashi learns Hakol Kol Yaakov was part of the brocha. That's the blessing. May your voice remain the voice of Yaakov. We use that. What's the brocha? Shanu Tzakim V'Nanim. When we shout to Hashem, Hashem answers us. We use that. Different way from you. And we got out of Egypt. Nabro no ba'atzecho. May we pass through your land. Loi navor besode uvecherim. We won't go through any fields or any vineyards. So there'll be no destruction. Loi nishte mei ve'er. And we will not drink the water of the well. Asks Rashi. Mei beirus o yotzorich lema. What does it mean, the water of the well? It should be the water of the wells. In the plural, wherever we go, we won't drink water. We have our own water supplies. We've got our be'er that comes with us. And we've got mon, our own food supplies. We undertake to lock those supplies away. We'll buy our provisions from you as we pass through. So there's. We won't turn right or left. We'll go where you tell us. Until we've passed through your borders. Vayomer Elov Edom, and Edom answers, Loi Sa'avor Bi. Absolutely not. Why not? Because what's Edom's, how does Edom win in business? By the destruction of the competitor. Not by doing business, by the competitive destruction. Pen Becherev Etzelikrosecha, I'll come out and destroy you with a sword. It says, Rashi, Atem is going Bekol Shorishchem Avichem Vorim Vanitzak El Hashem Vayishma Kolenu. You tell me how proud you are of the gift that your father gave you, that you call to Hashem using your voice, and Hashem answers. V'ani Etze Aleichem B'mashu Rishayni Obi. My father gave me a gift as well. V'alchar B'chotichya, you live by the sword. I'll come out and get you by the sword. You're not going to pass here. I'm going to make your life miserable. I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to deprive you of food and water. I'm not going to let you pass through my land and let you just try, and I'll destroy you totally. So Esav is in the destructive mode. Yaakov comes along offering a business deal, and Esav says that you're coming out of weakness. If Yaakov was strong, if Bnei Israel was strong, Edom would never have said that. He would have done the business. But here he's exploiting the weakness. This is my chance to climb in. This is my chance to destroy you. What am I going to do? For a little bit of business that we're going to do together, I'm going to save you as a nation and then have to deal with you afterwards. I can destroy you at the moment by not allowing you access to my resources, by not allowing you access to my territory. I'll destroy you totally. You'll wander around in the desert and the others will get you. Amalek will get you. Sichem will get you. There are big armies you're going to have to deal with. I won't have to even do anything. They'll wipe you out. You're my brother. I don't want to wipe you out. Just don't walk into my house. Keep outside. And the wolves will get you outside. This is his chance to exploit his weakness. That's the environment in which Esav operates. It's an anti-learning environment. Yaakov is an ishtam yoshev ohalim. Yaakov is a man who thinks. Yaakov is a man who learns. It's a completely different thing. And in learning as well, that's why the Gemara talks so seriously about halomeid al menas lekante, a person who learns in order to destroy other people. There's such a thing. To learn in order to shaloi lishmo, the Gemara says, a person learns shaloi lishmo, but it's good, at least shaloi lishmo, bo lishmo. A person does it for the wrong reasons. He does it because he wants to become a rabbi, he wants a position, he wants to become famous. That's why he's learning. Good, okay, so he's learning for the wrong reasons. But mito shaloi lishmo, bo lishmo. As a result of that, he'll benefit eventually. But haloi made lekanter, but if a person learns to be aggressive, to undermine other people, to destroy other people, and it would be better that he wasn't even created. That's a terrible thing. To turn learning into a tool of Esav, that's the worst thing altogether. That's the absolute worst. And so what do we see here? Two different dynamics, the Esav dynamic and the Yaakov dynamic, and they're mutually exclusive. What we see is the secular world is grappling with how to move from the Esav dynamic to the Yaakov dynamic, how to become learning organizations, how to be able to get into situations where the structures don't inhibit the process of learning. And sometimes, in our society where we should be there already, we sometimes find that learning becomes a basis for mutual destruction, for machlokes, for arguing against one another, for undermining one another. We're turning Torah into a kli of Esav, and they're turning the kli of Esav into a kli of learning. Very disturbing. In one sense, very wonderful. In one sense, very disturbing. But what's really important here is to realize how mutually exclusive these dynamics are and what it means by learning. And when we talk about being influenced by the environment in which we operate, we're not talking about being influenced and maybe you'll eat treif, being influenced and maybe you won't keep Shabbos. That's one problem. But there's a much more serious problem. And that's being influenced by the whole mindset. Being influenced by this whole winning kind of competitiveness. We have competitiveness too, but what are we competing against? We're competing against our own Yetzer Hara. We're competing against standards that the Torah sets for us. And that too the business world is beginning to move into. To try and compete against, they call it benchmarking. Setting absolute standards that are way beyond those of your competitors even. Doesn't matter. Don't look at your competitor to determine your standard. Your job is not to beat your competitor. Your job is to be really good. Set independent standards of what really good means. The whole business world is moving in that direction. But the competitive, what you're competing against is the standards you set for yourself. Or in our case, the standards the Torah sets for us. And we're competing against ourselves to reach those standards. Not against one another. There's no benefit to me if you get done in. There's no benefit to my knowledge if you don't have knowledge. On the contrary, the more knowledge there is, the better it is. And that's what learning is, when you've got a situation where it doesn't matter if you fail. There's also an article recently, just to show you how seriously this trend is being taken in Fortune magazine. showing how the man who made the biggest mistake at Coca-Cola, remember some time ago they started with a new Coke, and they nearly lost everything. And very quickly they spent fortunes and fortunes on the new Coke, and then they spent fortunes and fortunes on bringing the classic Coke back again, and it cost them a lot of money. The man who made that decision, of course, had to leave in rather a hurry, but he's back again. Because the tendency is people who've made mistakes are better than people who haven't. People who've made mistakes have the capacity to learn. People who've made mistakes are much more valuable. So now headhunters are running around looking for chief executives who've made major blunders in their lives, instead of looking for the guys who've never made a mistake. To show people that it's okay, it's not so serious. Making a mistake means that you're thinking, you're trying, you're learning. Much better to be somebody who's made a mistake and recovered from it than to be somebody who's never made a mistake. That's never been our view. You see to what extent this mega trend that I've been talking about is a reality. That the secular world is beginning to realize there's such a thing as a chet, and there's such a thing as tshuva. You can grow the mokum shebale tshuva in the immense tzadikim gemurim yecholim la'amod. If you made a mistake and you fixed it, you're much better than never having made the mistake in the first place. They've discovered that for themselves now. We're trying to get to zero defect. We don't understand that concept. We think somebody must never make a mistake, and if a frum person puts a step wrong, it's a terrible thing, and oh, and you're so disappointed and let down. What is it? If people make mistakes, people do wrong things, they correct the wrong things. Much greater to be self-correcting, to be able to live through a mistake, notice the mistake, fix the mistake, and grow from it, much better than never making a mistake. We understand that, and the business world is beginning to understand that. They're moving much, much closer to it. What we need to realize, though, is what it means. We have the secrets of learning. That's what Torah is. That's what Yiddishkeit is. We're a learning nation. We're probably the only learning nation that's ever existed. Not that other nations have never learned, but no other nation has learning at the center. No other nation has their whole structure designed to facilitate learning, to encourage learning, to produce learning. That's the essence of what being Jewish is. That's the essence of Torah. That's the essence of learning. And one can learn Torah in an anti-learning way, and one can learn Torah in a learning way. And we have to treasure what we've gotten to realize that, yes, we also conquer. Yitzchok gave us a bracha of Yishtachavu Lecho Lumim, that nations and peoples will bow down to us, but not because we've conquered them out of force, because we've conquered them with the brilliance of our own knowledge, of our understanding, of our nobility of spirit, and of our purity of living.